Hey, Josh.
How are you, Glenn?
Very good, thanks. How are you?
I'm pretty good. You know, as much as I like to teach, we are off all week this week for Thanksgiving, and you know, I do like to teach, but I don't mind being off for a couple of days from it.
It's a good thing. I don't know. It's semester is getting me down. I feel like I'm really working for a living now.
Yeah,
it's hard.
It's a tough job. Yeah. Well, that's why we get the big bucks. And No, it's been a pretty long semester here as well. I think I mentioned to you, or maybe I didn't. I don't know. I took on an additional kind of teaching burden this term. This is not the time or the place to get into all the details about it, but I was moderating a course on poverty alleviation at Google. It was really an amazingly. The course ended last week, although there are some additional some extra sessions to focus on some projects. But
is this a course among the employees, or that's something that's out on the web that people can be involved in?
The sessions are behind the firewall, but it was a course. So what happened was, when Google went public in 2004, they announced that they were forming a nonprofit wing called Google.org, and hired Larry Brilliant to be the CEO of Google.org, and announced that they were going to work in three areas, you know, on the principle that they don't go for low-hanging fruit. So it was climate change, global health, and global poverty.
I see.
And they gave Google gave the .org 1% of the stock value at the time of the IPO, 1% of annual profits.
And 1%?
Yeah.
That's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money. Yes, it's really a lot of money. And this is, I think, the most, you know, interesting and unusual thing is, you know, Google gives its tells its employees they can work for like 20, I'm not sure I know all the details, but for 20% of their time on projects that are not essential parts of their day job.
I see.
So they also gave Google.org a kind of access to employee time. So as if to say, our employees are our greatest asset, and they have a lot to contribute in these areas. But then they had the even more, unusual, startling, and I think quite totally correct insight, which was that as passionate, as energetic, as bright, and as interesting as Google employees are, that they don't really know very much about these areas. And they should learn something about it. So they decided that they were going to run courses on the topics that they were working on. And the first of these courses was on global economic development, poverty alleviation. And it was a 10-week course, met 2 hours a week. There were two talks a week, each talk sort of, you know, 25 or 30 minutes, and then an engaged discussion. And I was, opening things up by introducing the topics and then moderating the discussion between these were mostly Google employees, not .org employees, but .com employees. There were Google employees who were interested in doing stuff in these areas. And I have to say, the presentations were fantastic. I mean, really, you know, by very, very good people, a bunch of economists, some many of whom you would know, Lant Pritchett and Ted Miguel, who teaches at Berkeley, and Seema Jayachandran, who's here at Stanford, and Steve Radlett, who's at the Center for Global Development, Nancy Birdsall, who runs the Center for Global Development, Nancy Barry, who ran Women's World Banking for 15 years, and anyway, a whole bunch of people came, and the presentations were interesting, and they've now people in the .org learned a lot from the presentations, and it's helped to shape the projects that they're going to be devoting their time to, and now they're really trying in a more focused way to enlist the energies of Google employees. So
that sounds great. One of the advantages of being in Silicon Valley, then.
It turned out to be a huge advantage. And, I have to say, and we'll move off this topic in a second, and Google doesn't need me to be giving them accolades. Their stock price is already high enough, and I'm not going to move it at all. But I have to say, I don't think I've asked a bunch of people about this. I don't study, you know, what companies do by way of, you know, educating their employees. But to the best of my knowledge, no company has ever done anything like this before. You know, companies have executive education programs, but this wasn't for executives. They have, you know, they'll teach, you know, have programs so employees could learn, you know, yoga breathing or something, but this wasn't about yoga breathing. It wasn't about the latest in logistics, so it wasn't sort of specifically business related. It was open to all the employees, and it was really, you know, very high quality stuff. So I think it's, I think it was a fantastic thing, and it did add to my teaching responsibilities for the fall. But boy, was it fun and interesting, and I learned a lot from it. Anyway, on to bigger and better things, or smaller and lesser things, smaller and lesser. We both read, I think, the op-ed that Skip Gates wrote in the New York Times this week, 40 acres and a gap in wealth. And boy, did I think it was terrible.
Well, you know, there was this big story about the Pew Research Center report surveying. Juan Williams did a big piece on National Public Radio about it. It's gotten covered all over. Main empirical finding is that a big plurality of respondents amongst African Americans indicating that there is a schism between the black middle class and the black lower classes, and that, what was it, 37% of African Americans felt that blacks today can no longer be thought of as a single race because of this class divide.
Right.
I think the Times probably felt it necessary to have a major piece on the op-ed page. This was Sunday at the top of the page.
Right.
On this issue, which of course is important.
Yeah.
And I guess the thinking at the editorial page at the New York Times is, who else would you go to comment on this than Skip Gates? Now, and, you know, working in the field myself, it will sound a little bit like sour grapes if I criticize him, but I thought it was just an awful piece, really, I did.
All right, a little sour grapes, not a bad thing, you know, turn it into good wine if we're lucky, but...
well, I don't care who
let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
Have you read the Pew Report?
I've not read the Pew Report. I've not had time to read it yet.
Okay, so I read some stories about the Pew Report. I didn't hear the Juan Williams report. Now, maybe I'm confused about which report this was. I thought the big finding in this Pew Report was about downward mobility among African Americans, that something like 45% of African Americans born into the middle class in the mid 1960s were now in the bottom quintile.
Yeah, that's right. The downward mobility across generations amongst blacks, yeah, much greater than amongst whites.
Yeah.
The upward mobility for blacks much less than for whites.
Yeah. Right.
And that's right. And there have been, you know, pieces written about that too. I don't know if this is the same Pew report or two different Pew reports, but this is what you just stated, another finding coming out of Pew just recently that's also gotten a lot of attention.
That seemed like a bigger finding than the finding that 37% of African Americans think that black, that this is the quote that comes from the Gates article,
yeah,
blacks, that he's quoting the Pew report. 37% of African Americans polled felt that blacks today can no longer be thought of as a single race.
Well, you know, it depends on whether your point of view is about identity,
yeah,
in which case you're worried or concerned or, you know, alarmed or whatever about this kind of fragmentation of African American identity and what it might mean, or whether or not it's, you know, social structural. And you're, in which case you're interested in what the underlying processes might be that inhibit social mobility. You know how important you may think social mobility is for a sense of equity in society, and you know what the ramifications are, what the implications are of this kind of greater downward mobility, I should say, amongst blacks. What's going on in the African American middle class? One might begin to ask these kind of questions. But I guess it did, you know, which of those findings most strikes you as interesting, I think, depends on your point of view.
I guess the thing that, you know, there was this huge disparity, as you say, between downward mobility for African Americans and downward mobility for whites, and really, and not just the disparity, but the sheer absolute numbers on the downward mobility for African Americans was pretty startling and depressing, as are the issues about, you know, issues about persistent poverty. One of the things that I found striking about the Gates piece, though, let me say first, it took a little bit of time to get past the completely shameless name-dropping. I mean, I don't know how many words the piece is, but let's say it's about 1,000 words, but in 1,000 words you mention the conversation that you had with James Q. Wilson and with William Julius Wilson. You mention the conversation that you had with Whoopi Goldberg when you showed Whoopi Goldberg about how her ancestors were beneficiaries of a land grant.
Yeah.
And then
and then
you conclude with the conversation with what John Kenneth Galbraith once told you. I don't know.
Along the way, you extol Margaret Thatcher's social policy.
Yeah,
you suggest that Daniel Patrick Moynihan was right about, and more than right about, the collapse of the black family. Too bad nobody listened. You forget that Jesse Jackson spent a big part of his career in the 1970s and early 1980s advocating for self-help among blacks and telling black kids to down with dope and up with hope.
Yeah.
The piece is scatological, Josh, in my opinion. I mean, he goes from black culture needs to be reformed to there should have been 40 acres and a mule, because guess what? He studied 20 African-American families, and he has a social science conclusion based on that about the importance of wealth.
Listen, Glenn, if you or I wrote something for the op-ed for the New York Times, and we said something as boneheadedly ridiculous about some work of literature, as Skip Gates says in his social science, with his social science hat on, I mean, first of all, we wouldn't have been published there, and secondly, we would be appropriate objects of the kind of ridicule from peers that we're heaping on Skip now. I mean, ridiculous. You do a study with 20 people, and here's the finding. The finding is, this is, you know, as we social scientists call it, sampling on the dependent variable. You look at 20 very really, really incredibly successful African Americans. I mean, this is, you know, it's Oprah Winfrey, it's Whoopi Goldberg, it's, you know, Jackie Joyner.
Josh, I hear you. I hear you, and I know where you're going. Here's what I want to say. It's not about the truth.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole point here, and political scientist Adolf Reed, I think, named this and really nailed it in a piece, maybe it's 10 years ago, maybe more, in the Village Voice, called something like Buona. What are the drums saying?
Uh-huh.
Okay?
Uh-huh.
And so that's a metaphor for the fact that a certain kind of African-American intellectual establishes himself within the American cultural elite
as
an interpreter of the drums.
Right.
If you want to know what's up with the Negro folk, there's certain people that you go to, and their art is the characterization or the expression of it in a manner that's just not too rough to the sensibility of the typical reader of the New York Times or the New Yorker's ear. And what Adolf Reed says is that Gates and others, and a few others, Cornel West among them, have sort of cornered this market.
Yeah.
And it's to the detriment of serious, well, in Reed's case, political critique, in our case, of social analysis. It's not about the truth. It's about posturing. It's about entertainment. I mean, the reason the name-dropping, the reason the Whoopi Goldberg and the Oprah Winfrey, is that the reason that there can be a project called African-American Lives and African-American Roots, which, in a documentary way, looks into the family histories of some prominent athletes and entertainers, the reason that this can happen is because it's really about, you know, producing this this kind of glitzy, this kind of inside the cultural elite, this kind of entertainment product, which is, there's a demand for it out there, no doubt about it. But what it's doing coming out of Harvard, I really don't know.
Yeah. Well, it's I guess the thing, you know, at the end of the day, when you get past the shameless name dropping, okay, well, that's too bad. When you get past the fact that the piece is all over the place, as you say, I mean, it's got Margaret Thatcher on, you know, Margaret Thatcher version of 40 Acres and a Mule. It's got give out, you know, copies of Dr. Seuss. That's what Jesse Jackson should be doing. And as you rightly say, Jesse Jackson has, you know, been on the self-help.
Yeah, I mean, this is no brief for Jesse Jackson, but yeah.
Yeah, no, I understand. He's been there, done that.
Exactly.
And then the quote from Galbraith is that the first step in reversing economic inequalities is greater voter participation, and I think he was right. So now we've got something for everybody. It's about voter participation. But didn't you just say that it was about self-help and about reading books?
And about wealth accumulation.
But didn't you say, just say before that it was about wealth? So there's a little here for everybody. So it's bad as social analysis. It's all over the place. Shameless name-dropping. But the thing that I thought was, in a way, I don't know, worst about it. I mean, why compete? There are so many bad things. But here's another really bad thing about this. It starts off with this, what it's reported as the astonishing finding that 37% of African Americans feel that blacks can no longer be thought of as a single race. Now, first of all, I read that more than half full. 63% of African Americans think that blacks can still be thought of as a single race. I don't know if that's more or less than it was 30 years ago. I have no basis for comparison. But after reporting on these kind of identity-based divisions within the black community, Skip says is the message here is that it's time to examine the differences between black families on either side of the divide for clues about how to address an increasingly entrenched inequality. Now, here's the headline sentence. We can't afford to wait any longer to address the causes of persistent poverty among most black families. And I think I agree that addressing the causes of persistent poverty among, you know, black families, very important thing to do. But I didn't think it had to wait until you discovered that there was a kind of identity division.
Nor are we going to get answers, I should think, to that problem by looking at, you know, the family histories of successful black families and less successful black families. I mean, the reason Galbraith said register these poor people to vote so that they could vote for public officials who would use the apparatus of government and the state in ways that would be more felicitous to the development of African-American lower-class communities. I mean, that's about real policies. It's about taxes. It's about the minimum wage. It's about immigration. It's about the earned income tax credit. It's about how you reform welfare. It's about what you do with urban development. It's about employment training. It's about health care. I could go on for a very long time, Josh.
Oh, that's so old-fashioned, though, Glenn. Come on.
Pardon?
Policy matters to people's lives. Old-fashioned. Just kidding.
but I'm saying, you know, why vote? If the answer is 40 Acres and a Mule, or if the answer is hand out Dr. Seuss books to lower-class kids, or if the answer is mimic Margaret Thatcher's council housing policy about extending ownership to people living in public housing, which, by the way, was the favorite program of a certain Republican politician that no one remembers anymore named Jack Kemp.
Jack Kemp.
15 years ago.
Yeah. You know, and the thing is, if you want to talk about giving out assets to people, you could say, why not say, not 40 Acres and a Mule, but, you know, there's Bruce Ackerman and Ann Alstott, and they've got their idea of giving endowments of $80,000 to people, or you've got universal basic income / negative income tax proposals. There are plenty of people other than Margaret. Anyway.
Yeah, let me just say one other thing about it.
Yeah.
Of course the families which were most resourceful, most intelligent, successful are going to both spawn offspring who do well in life and manage to accumulate land in the tough conditions for African Americans of the late 19th and early 20th century.
Yeah.
So there's no causal inference to be drawn from the fact that Oprah Winfrey's forebears may have owned land in the South. Of course. You know, I mean, it's as if he says, If they had only given people land, then they would have been successful. But he can't possibly know that from the fact that those people who were successful also owned land. I mean, I hope that doesn't sound obscure to people who might be listening to this, because it's such a fundamental point.
He does say that. He said, if there's a meaningful correlation between the success of accomplished African Americans today and their ancestors' property ownership, we can only imagine how different black-white relations would be had 40 acres and a mule really been official government policy in the Reconstruction South. That's exactly the inference you're complaining about.
Exactly.
But, you know, this is we're doing due diligence here,
yeah,
because it's easy to complain about people who are in another line of work and, you know, complain that they're not doing it well. And we're going to get to that in a little while. But here we've got somebody who's, you know, we both know, very, you know, at the height of a certain kind of academic success.
Yeah, but Josh,
plenty
of
ex-
I'm sorry, I interrupted you, Josh.
No. I was going to say.
Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was
plenty of access and you know, this thing is, I don't know what's the right word for it. Crap, bullshit, tarot. It's just.
But wait a minute. This is the greatest university in the world. This is Harvard University. This is the pinnacle of academic and intellectual. Okay. Now we're discussing black people, African Americans. This is not a small matter. It's important. Getting it right is important.
Really?
Having the very best work done and then communicated is really important. What's up with an institution that puts the characterization of contemporary conditions of African Americans into the hands of people who don't know what they're doing?
Yeah.
And what's up with a mechanism of public communication, I'm talking about the New York Times now, that takes this precious resource, which is its editorial page, and turns it over to somebody who doesn't know what he's talking about.
So, and your answer to that question is that this is that what you do is you hand it over to this a certain kind of person who's positioned him or herself as being the official interpreter of black culture and black life for white Americans.
Correct. And what I'm saying is, if we were talking about something really important here, like science, or war and peace, or something, it wouldn't be so. The mediocrity, I'm sorry, the amateurishness wouldn't be tolerated.
Yeah.
So, Gates has influence, and maybe I'm not going to get a grant somewhere that I want one day. Good, good. I hope he hears it.
this is part of a, you know, there's a wider phenomenon here the public intellectual, and there are good and bad public intellectuals. There are a lot of public intellectuals who aren't in the academy, and I think both of us think, maybe it's just because of where we sit, but we both think that there's some important value to being in the academy and to publishing in the journals and to being subject to the kinds of intellectual discipline that comes from, being a member of an academic department and having to make your case to colleagues who know at least as much as you do, more than you, about most of the topics that you write about.
Right.
And so then we can have somebody like, we've talked about the case of, Skip, the only thing that we disagree about is which part of his worst. And I'm not sure how deep that disagreement goes, but what about, let's talk about this issue a little bit, about what is the value of, that kind of academic discipline. We've talked before about the case of Dinesh D'Souza, who's written some really monstrously bad stuff. He was, until recently, he was an external fellow of the Hoover Institution, and I've been looking on the Hoover website, and I'm not sure that Dinesh is any longer an external fellow of Hoover.
You can't find him on the website.
You can't find him on the website, and I'm checking into what the situation here, because he wrote that book on 9/11.
Yeah.
That started off not with the first sentence, but with the second sentence, saying that, you know, the cultural left in the United States was responsible for 9/11, which it was just
scurrilous
and beyond stupid. I mean, really, just dumbass.
I know the argument. Maybe it's become so embarrassing that the funders have pulled out, or somebody in Hoover. I don't know. We'll find out soon enough.
But you know, have some, you know, some interest in this topic because of the importance in some of the areas that you've worked in of people who come at the issues in a, you know, from, you know, who write about issues from a non-academic way and from a non-academic background. I mean, maybe the classic case of this was the bell curve.
That's right, Charles Murray and Richard Herrnstein, the bell curve. Actually, Charles Murray is at the American Enterprise Institute as a senior fellow, and Dinesh D'Souza had been at the American Enterprise Institute before he moved out to the West Coast as a fellow. And they produced some books in the mid-1990s, D'Souza's book called The End of Racism, which I thought was awfully bad and insulting and egregiously unacademic. And Murray and Herrnstein's book, The Bell Curve, which everybody knows about and was quite on intelligence on IQ, not mainly about race, although they did have a chapter on racial differences in IQ. It was very controversial, playing up the old line about the heritability, the genetically determined basis of IQ, and the futility of social policy, which was constrained by the fact that people were unequal in their intelligence, and so on. And I actually resigned from the American Enterprise Institute's academic advisory board. I was one of a number of more or less distinguished academics who served there, because I thought these books were just profoundly inconsistent with standards of standards of evidence, standards of proof, the quality, the vetting by peers who are specialists in the various fields. In some ways, D'Souza's book isn't even worth discussing in this context, because it, like much of his writing, was just a kind of cartoon, a screed, a sort of, you know, more or less well-written, kind of send-up of the academic left. Murray's book, I think, Murray and Herrnstein's Dead, was much more mischievous, because it went forward under this pretense that they were simply reporting what the scientific community in neurology and cognitive psychology and in the social sciences, economics, and sociology, what the scientific community had already come to know but were too polite to say out loud. One of the values of the academy is the discipline that comes with having to get past really smart people who know deeply the technical aspects of how one might be handling data and evidence, how one's trying to draw conclusions of the nature of the arguments that one is making. And there's a kind of vetting that goes on in that. There's a back and forth that goes on in that. It gets read by some people, especially since this rise of a kind of right-wing suspicion of the university. It gets read by some people, this vetting, as being politically motivated.
Yes.
And it sometimes has been politically motivated. But in the main, what it's about is the way we consensually, as a community of inquirers, of investigators, come to know something is by bandying it about among each other and having to persuade the great majority of our community, who are experts and who are deeply trained, that what we have to say has value. Murray did an end run around that process with the bell curve. There's a lot that's wrong in the bell curve that has been spelled out in detail by reviewers in psychology and in economics and other fields in the reviews that came out after the book was published. Yeah. But he's never really been held accountable for it. And the sort of straw that broke the camel's back for me at the AEI was when I went to the president of Christopher DeMuth, and I said, you know, look, Murray has put this book out there. 200,000 copies of it has been sold. Mm-hmm. If you pick up the reviews, you see everywhere you look, deep and profound criticisms of it that he's never answered. He wrote one reply to his critics, which was in Commentary magazine, Mm-hmm. The neoconservative magazine edited by Norman Podhoretz and Neil Cazadore, and which said, of course the academics are upset. What can they do? I just burst their balloon.
Right, right.
You know,
but isn't there maybe some truth in? I mean, let's focus down on this a little bit. I mean, we've talked about this before. It is true that there's the spectrum of opinion in the academy, the political spectrum in the academy. Is a pretty small subset of the political spectrum in the country more generally. It's true, I think people have noted this, that if you look at the distribution of intellectuals in universities, it's, you know, more sort of center, liberal, left. If you look at the distribution of intellectuals at think tanks, they're more conservative, Republican, maybe libertarian. And so you describe, you know, a very attractive vetting process for ideas, and in some fields, I don't know, microbiology or in, you know, some areas of experimental physics or in chemistry, that vetting process really works. Those are the areas of normal science where people know what the questions are, they know how you go about answering a question, and you publish something in a peer-reviewed journal, and, you know, maybe counts for a great deal. When you look in other areas of the field, arguably, they're governed by a kind of, you know, cultural and political consensus that makes things that may be true, certainly that may be worth saying, even if they're not true, that make them kind of hard to say. It's harder to be, as you know from your own experience, it's harder to be a conservative in the academy, and is it really that clear that the vetting process that you're describing works as well as you describe it? I mean, does it have a kind of false consensus building and imposing character to it, or is it really you know, a way of testing good and bad ideas and winnowing out the bad ones?
Well, you know, that's a big subject. I do acknowledge and accept that there's political correctness in the academy, and that if you pick up, I mean, I'm just going to name a journal, the American Journal of Sociology. I mean, no offense to the American Journal of Sociology, but you'll flip through it. You could flip through it, and you could probably find articles that are, you know, consistent with a certain party line, whether it's about poverty or, you know, the culture or whatever, and you probably not find articles that sort of come at these questions in a way that's more friendly to the right, and that's all very true. And I think that has spawned a tendency in some areas of research, especially that bear on policy, to develop, you know, counter centers of expertise outside of the academy where people are less subject to these constraints. But my point about vetting, I mean, if you're at AEI and you want to write about tax policy or intelligence or poverty or whatever, in my view, you should also want to get the benefit of the sort of criticism of people who are deeply practiced and expert in the field. And I don't see that the two things are mutually incompatible. I guess that's what I'm trying to say at the end of the day, that the technical value of the vetting and the independence of mind to be able to go against what might be a consensus a political point of view strike me as not being inconsistent with each other. I mean, I can only talk about the field of economics, which I know very well. And of course there are biases and quirks and, you know, peculiarities of the various journals. They have more to do with research style, I think, than they have to do with political content. But if you came out and said about, let's say, the problem of poverty that you were talking about in the global context, and you came out and said, look, all this aid stuff is bunk, it's not going to help anybody, it's basically culture or genes, right? Africa is impoverished because of culture and genes, not because of colonialism. A whole lot of people would be very upset about it, and you'd get a lot of flack, and you might get your paper rejected somewhere. But at the end of the day, that argument is being made, isn't it? I mean, I think that argument is getting out there, and we want that to the extent that that argument is being made, we want it to be, you know, scientifically sound.
Absolutely. I mean, there is a version of that argument, and I want to be very careful about this, about a piece of that argument, which is on aid.
Yeah.
Aid not doing any good. I happen to have the book here on my desk, the Bill Easterly book, The White Man's Burden.
Yeah, I've seen.
And, you know, I think this is a good example of a book that, I think well of it. I mean, I don't agree with all of it, mm-hmm. and I'll make some critical comments in a second on it. But this, you know, Easterly is a very serious economist who makes the case that there have been, you know, $2.3 trillion that have gone into aid programs, and that that money has been basically more or less wasted. And he thinks that as the title, The White Man's Burden, indicates, he thinks the money's been wasted because it's been guided along with policies of military intervention as well, which he's not, you know, tender about either, all been guided by a kind of patronizing, paternalistic, racist, imperial, colonial sensibility.
Yeah.
The thing that I think is important and interesting about the book is that Easterly knows the literature that makes the arguments on the other side about how aid has been helpful, or about how aid has been helpful under certain kinds of circumstances. For example, if you have decent governance in place, then aid does contribute, whereas it's, you know, you're excuse my language, pissing the money away if the governance is bad. And he tells you which of the articles that have made this case he thinks are good. There's some stuff done by Clements, Radelet, and Bhavnani, people who are at the Center for Global Development. And he argues, tells you why he thinks those arguments are wrong. So he takes the arguments seriously. And also, at the end of the day, he isn't anti-aid. What he is he's opposed to giving assistance that isn't tied to pretty specific programs, and preferably specific programs that have been road tested in some kind of controlled experiment way of the kind of MIT's Poverty Action Lab style. So I think this is a good example of a book that's had a big impact, that's very carefully done, that's helped to improve the work that's been written. All of that said, I think somewhere in the course of writing the thing, and here you never know exactly where to blame the author and where to blame the people at Penguin who published the book, there are kind of exaggerated from one of the world, this is the back cover, from one of the world's best-known development economists, an excoriating attack on the tragic hubris of the West's efforts to improve the lot of the developing world.
This is the kind of thing that gets Jeff Sachs, the economist at Columbia, very, very upset. I mean, there's a scientific argument between Easterly and Sachs about just those propositions you were going over.
Right.
But there's also this rhetorical contest going on.
Right.
About what the narrative line is going to be. Is the line going to be, look, we tried to help these people, it did more harm than it did good, and the best we can do is just back off? Or is the line going to be, oh my God, global poverty is the horror, is the ethical challenge of our time, we must redouble our efforts and commit ourselves? And, you know, it seems to me that you can learn the wisdom of an Easterly critique and take it seriously, and at the same time remain morally committed to seeing this problem as a problem for all of humankind, and a problem that that compels us to commitment, to action, and to sacrifice. I mean, those things are not necessarily inconsistent.
They're not incompatible, and also they're not inconsistent with, and this is what I think, this is the point of mentioning the Easterly book. I think it's not inconsistent with taking a respect for evidence and argument and clarity of proposition seriously. Easterly lays it out there. Now, he also lays it on thick. He's a little bit, you know, gets a little, you know, metaphorical in places. You don't sell as many books as he's been saying by saying that things are complicated, and things get a little oversimplified and, as I say, a little bit rhetorical. But, hey, you know, it happens to everybody. I think as an example of how you can take an important problem take the evidence and argument seriously, take clarity seriously, write something that's responsible to the evidence and responsible to the arguments that are being made. I think it's a pretty good example of it, although I wish the packaging had been a little bit less brilliant and blistering indictment of the failure of Western aid.
Mind you now,
the poor, angry and irreverent. We need to face our own history of... face our own history of ineptitude and hold our own aid agencies accountable for the results of their actions, especially at a time when the plight of the world's poor is one of the most pressing issues we face. Now, I agree about that, but there's something else that Easterly says in this thing, which is he tells you what kind of assistance you ought to be giving.
And,
so it's not all just pissing on people who've done the wrong thing.
And he's making his argument from within the discipline. I mean, Bill Easterly is a well-respected. I mean, he shows up at the conferences. You can't get Charles Murray to show up in anything. He answers his colleagues. I mean, the body of work of which this book is representative is built on scholarly research, getting grants from the main scientific supporters of this kind of research, and publishing in the mainstream journals. He comes around to conferences and to academic departments and presents to small groups and deals with the criticisms that come up and so forth and so on.
Yeah. One thing that I want to mention, we should probably move on, but one thing I want to mention when you were, characterizing the terms of the debate, and you mentioned, it is very much true, which is that the kind of global poverty and destitution debate is increasingly an argument, as in the Paul Collier book, The Bottom Billion, increasingly an argument about sub-Saharan Africa.
Yeah.
Because if you look at the places where most poor people in the world are, it's not sub-Saharan Africa. The places where most poor people under $2 a day, under $1 a day poverty,
China.
It's China and India, because that's where most of the people are.
Yeah,
those are
exactly.
Pretty poor countries. But when you got a place that's growing to 10 to 12% a year, doubling GDP per capita, if you're growing, growing 10% a year, you double it every 7 years. And they've also never taken a
They're not going to be poor for long if they can
They're
solve
not going to be poor for long. Right,
exactly.
In an expected value sense, they're not. The problem of poverty maybe is being addressed there, although the earth may be suffering a lot from it and the water supplies around Beijing may be suffering.
We've got big problems, Josh.
We'll have plenty to talk about.
the
interesting thing, one of the most interesting upbeat things that I heard was in one of the last presentations, and this was by Ted Miguel, who's a development economist at Berkeley, and he gave a presentation on what's been happening for the last 5 to 7 years in sub-Saharan Africa. And actually, the story is 3% plus growth rates continent-wide over a period of 5 to 7 years, first time in more than 30 years that there really has been sustained positive economic performance. Now, there's a big question, very open question, and of practical importance as well as intellectual importance about what the sources of that are. Is it commodity prices? Is it Chinese infrastructural investment? Is it governance reforms? A lot more democracy and rule of law in Africa than there was 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Some evidence that it's governance reforms. But the thing that he was emphasizing, and I think it's we should accept good news while we're listing all the bad news. What looks like is happening is, as I say, for the first time since the mid 1970s or something like that, what you have is a real not just 1 year uptick and not just in one country, but a sustained turnaround in economic performance. Could be dragged down. Still a lot of big civil wars in some, pretty nasty neighborhoods there. Climate keeps getting bad, and those places are going to be hit really, really badly, really tough. But just mixing in a bit of good news into the story, looks like there's some good news there.
3% continent-wide growth over the last 5 to 7 years. That's something I didn't know.
It's pretty, it's really...
what's next on our agenda?
Next on our agenda, so now that we've talked about the shamelessness in Gates...
At great and career-inhibiting length.
Yeah. Great and career inhibiting length.
Come on, man.
Exactly.
This guy is known in certain quarters. Yeah. I'm talking about Henry Louis Gates Jr. as the Booker T. Washington of our time, which is to say, you know, if you really want the Ford Foundation or somebody to do something for you, you know, he's the guy that they're going to run it past if it has to do with race, and he's likely to say no if he's not happy with you. This is what I've heard. I don't know if it's true or not.
Listen, I've sat through many conversations over many years with Gene Rivers, and there isn't anything that you've said that Gene didn't say in much more colorful terms.
I don't know about that.
as you can well imagine.
Yeah.
How about let's try something. We talked about it a little bit before, but something I don't know really different. Let's talk about religion. So
all right.
There's Glenn Lowry went through a period of being born again. Described yourself in a previous conversation as not being as good a Christian as
I used to be,
as you used to be, or maybe as you should be. Well, but at least you said as you used to be. Here I am. I'm a secular. Never had any religious upbringing. As I think I've said before in conversations with you, Glenn, I don't have the kind of Dan Dennett militant anti, religiosity. And so I only hesitate in describing myself as an atheist because it conveys that militant religiosity, whereas I have a very deep intellectual interest in religion, and have written some about it in work in political philosophy about the role of religious claims in political discourse and about religious exemptions from law, and I've also read a lot of theology along with the Bible and the Quran, and spent a lot of time reading about Confucianism. So I have an intellectual interest that I think it's in it, but I'm not a kind of I'm not an insider to it, and I thought maybe we could.
Let me start talking then. I mean, I will just say, yes. I went through a period in my life, a lot of personal adversity and turmoil in my life. My marriage almost breaking up, a problem with drugs and alcohol, public embarrassment about various things, and I found some comfort and essential support in a newly acquired Christian faith as I was coming through those years and coming out of it. And for a while, I'm thinking back now, late 80s, early 90s, my two sons with my second wife, Linda, were born in 1989 and 1991, respectively, and it just seemed like a miraculous transformation of my life was ongoing, and the church, a relatively theologically conservative African-American Protestant church, was really central to our lives as a family and to my life personally in those years. But I don't know. Various things happened to me, and I won't go into great detail. I'm happy to talk about them, but I don't want to take too much of our time just talking about myself to say that, around 95, 96, 97, I sort of, the intellectual in me, the kind of, can I really try to understand something in terms of intellect and not just in terms of my feeling or my emotion or my sort of desperate need for order in my life or the kind of transcendent sense of calm and such that one, in actual religious experience, I mean in the experience of worship, of prayer, almost the kind of ecstatic aspects of it, the kind of stuff that, people have been talking about for a long time. William James, I think of, and others, many. It sort of came into conflict with my more rationalistic, more analytical, more kind of, can I give a real account? I mean, the bottom line on this for me is that I just couldn't make myself believe in magic. You know, I couldn't make myself believe in stuff that I could not give reasons for, that I could not provide arguments for. And I didn't want to be asked to believe in things that I couldn't give reasons for. So I felt myself cooling off to this and unable to go through the motions quite with the same enthusiasm and feeling fraudulent. I stepped down from Prison Fellowship Ministries, which was a conservative, Charles Colson-led, but very good, I think, effort to help people in prison throughout the world. I stepped down mainly because I couldn't keep going to those meetings and praying with those men and women and kind of, you know, going through this enactment when I didn't really deeply feel the conviction. It felt so fraudulent to me. And even though I liked the work and I got along quite well with people, political differences notwithstanding, I felt that I had to step out of that milieu. And I've stepped back, far back from involvement in my local church. Perhaps to my former pastor's chagrin, he's a good man, Ray Hammond of the Bethel AME Church.
I know, he's a very good man.
He's a very good
man. Wonderful person.
I have tremendous admiration for him and his wife and his children and the fellowship that worships with them. But no, it just hasn't been the path for me. So I'm out here. I'm very interested in religion. I read a lot about both the politics, the political philosophy and such, and also about the...
I'm curious, Glenn, if I had... asked you, let's say in 1990 or 1992, you know, what, tell me, don't tell me why you believe in God or in the, have accepted Jesus Christ as your Savior or why you believe that Jesus Christ is your Savior. If I didn't say why do you believe that, but just tell me what it is that you believe. What is
okay?
What would you have said? You know, if you would just again not justify it, but just elaborate for me. If I had said to you, elaborate for me, just what the content of your beliefs is. What do you think you would have said?
Well, I think I would have said something like, "There's a God in heaven, who made the world, and who fashioned a way for us transient beings." To be in relationship with his transcendent self. And that way is through Jesus Christ, our Lord and Savior, and, you know, so the stuff goes. But it would have been simply that. It would have been that the maker of the world is interested in me. And, of course, if you'd asked me in 1991, Josh, I would have had to say he's also interested in you. You know what I'm saying? In other words, in other words, I can't believe this and know this to be true and not share it with you, Josh, because I don't want your soul to wander forever or whatever, you know. But I would have said the point, the main point here is that there is a God who made the world, and he's interested in each and every one of us, and there is a way to be in relationship with him, and here's the way.
And so let me... explain, you know, why I asked the question, and then we can come back to the things that you said about there's a God in heaven, that God made the, there's a God, that God is in heaven, that God made the world, and that that God fashioned a way for is that God is concerned with each individual, and fashioned a way for each individual to be in connection with Him.
Yeah, so, and through I might just add, and having established that connection. There's power, as our president has said, wonder-working power. There's transformative power in that relationship. You will be made new. You will be empowered to achieve things that you never thought were. You can conquer the obstacles that have been heretofore holding you back and so forth.
So here's what I... So there's a tradition... a tradition of thinking that the core of religious conviction is ethical. It's not metaphysical. It's not a kind of quasi-scientific belief about how the world was created. I mean, maybe that's true as well, but that's part of it. But the core is a set of ethical convictions. And you get this in... among others in Spinoza, and you get it in Kant, as a statement about what the nature of religion is, that the essence of it is an ethical conviction, and then that ethical set of ethical convictions about the importance of individuals and the importance of their lives and the importance of some kind of community between and among individuals, etc. That set of convictions is then given a kind of, you know, surrounded with a kind of a story about creation and communication, etc. But the real, and for a long time, I thought okay, if that's, I think that makes a certain amount of sense to me, and I can understand. I have my ways of expressing my ethical convictions, and if somebody wants to say express a conviction about, say, human equality, by saying not simply that human beings are of equal importance, but by saying all human beings were created by a God who loves them, I could think of that as just a different, you know, vocabulary, so to speak, for expressing the same kind of moral conviction. But then I came across a study that was reported about 10 years ago in Time magazine, and it was a study on religious beliefs of Americans. And I don't remember the details exactly, but at first approximation, the story went something like this. So the story, it would say, they would ask people, so do you believe that there is a God? And, you know, 90% of the respondents would say, yes, they did. And then they would say, well, does he have a beard? And 35% would say, yes, he has a beard. And then they would say, well, do you believe in hell? And, you know, 80% of people would say they believed in hell. And then they say, is it really hot there? And 35% would say, yes, it's really hot there. So there were a large number of people who would express religious beliefs. And I'd think, well, you know, they have their way of expressing their ethical convictions. I've got my way. Mine isn't religious. Theirs is. But I feel like I understand what's being said. But then there were those, you know, 35% of people who would insist that it was, you know, on giving a kind of literalism to the religious beliefs, and those were the ones that I didn't understand. I felt like, well, I don't understand what they believe.
Let me see if I can help out here a little bit, because I don't accept this. It well may be as a kind of anthropological account of religion, yeah, as a cultural practice, yeah, that you could give an account of it that emerges out of, well, there's a core kind of moral sense or, yeah, set of ethical, yeah, convictions, and, yeah, then one needs a narrative in order to make those things sort of, you know, packageable and transmittable and communicable and so forth.
Right.
But I think that's putting...
That was Spinoza's view. It was ethics plus local color for the purposes of transmission.
Yeah, okay. I get that. I see that. Yeah. I can imagine a guy like Spinoza putting it, yeah, just like that. But, yeah, in the church where we worship, yeah, yeah, that's putting the cart before the horse.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? In other words, what good does it do you to know all of these rules if you don't feel the power within you, mm-hmm, of a living God who moves you to obey those rules and to embody, yeah, those rules in your life?
Right.
And so, and then this is why I became a bad Christian, because I, yeah, could not buy the metaphysical claims. But the,
yeah,
metaphysical,
right,
but, and I also couldn't continue in the religious practice denying the metaphysical claims.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if,
right,
this is all a ruse, if these are all just pretty words and a song and, yes, dance that we go through in order to get us around to seeing certain basic truths which are really independent of any,
yeah,
particular religious claim,
yeah. Yeah.
Then you know, I don't need that, you,
right,
know. But, right, but the actual position is quite the contrary of that, yeah, and the reason why perhaps so many people are so literalist, and I'm not a literalist, and I never was,
yeah,
is their maybe intuitive grasping of this idea, which is that, you know, it's all about the blood. That's the way the Christians would say it. It's all, mm-hmm, about something that actually happened in history.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
there,
yeah,
was a man who was the, right, Son of God, who walked on earth, who died, and who rose and sits at the right hand side, mm-hmm, and through who, belief in whom, you too can come into this relationship. And if those, yeah, claims are false, which I have,
yeah,
come to think they probably are, I mean, how could they, yeah, be true? I'm thinking, yeah, et cetera, et cetera. And my Christian, yeah, friends out there, I hate to offend you, but, you know, this is what, yeah, we're talking about here.
Yeah.
If those claims are false, then they're false.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. They're not metaphorically true.
So I might
just
as well go to Kant. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, the,
yeah,
Sermon on the Mount is poetry.
Yeah.
You know, and it's powerful lyrical poetry. And I believe it expresses ethical truths.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the deduction of them as true with a capital,
yeah,
T is more likely to be found in Kant than it is to be found in the New Testament.
You know, when you said it's all about the blood, I had a very bright flash of seeing the... the movie The Passion,
which
I saw three or four times,
wow.
And that was all about the blood.
You're not kidding.
I mean, it was a very powerful expression of the idea that it was all about the blood. So, but then to put yourself back in 1990 when you were a believer. And if I had, I would, I've never said anything like this to anybody who is. I don't have any desire to convert anybody from belief to non-belief. I just think these are, you know, topics that, you know, are best, you know, left alone. People should, you know, these convictions are important to people, and it's very easy to insult and offend.
Sure.
But if I had said to you in 1990. So, Glenn, you think that there is a God, and the God is in heaven. I don't. It's not that I might have said something to you like, it's not that I exactly disagree with that. Of course, I don't. It's not that I agree with it either. I'm just not sure what you're. I'm not sure what you're saying.
Yeah.
There's a God who's in heaven. What are you?
Yeah, well, I don't require the heaven part, but I take I see where you're going, and I agree with you. It's an unintelligible claim. It could be an unintelligible claim. And you know what it reminds me of, Josh? I'm not going to answer you directly. It reminds me of this great play, A Raisin in the Sun, by Lorraine Hansberry. And there's a scene in there where this is an African-American family in Chicago in the 1950s.
Right.
It's about race in America, and obviously we can't tell the whole plot of the play, but there's a scene in there with this family that's hard-pressed. There's a daughter who's going to college or wants to go to college or whatever, and she's an intellectual, and she's questioning a lot of stuff. And there's her mother who came up from the South during the Great Migration to Chicago to try to raise a family, and whose husband has died, worked himself to death trying to take care of his family, and who still has hopes and dreams for her children and grandchildren, and who is a devout Christian believer. Mm-hmm. And there's a scene where the daughter basically questions her mother's faith.
Mm-hmm.
And the mother goes up and slaps her face and says, "Repeat after me. In my mother's house, there is still God."
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
she makes her daughter, Benita, repeat that phrase, and her daughter mm-hmm. repeats it. And then when the mother leaves the room, she mutters the daughter under her breath, "Well, all the tyranny in the world won't put a God in heaven."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I've read that play with my older son, mm-hmm. with my whole family, but my older son, who was a declared agnostic, and we joust about religious stuff all the time, because even though I'm not as good a Christian as I used to be, I'm still sympathetic to the enterprise, and he has no sympathy for it. He's 18. He thinks for himself. We go through that, and I try to get him to see what the daughter's offense was there. And I try to get him to see that the nature of the debate between the daughter and the mother in that scene in A Raisin in the Sun is not about a fact claim.
Mm-hmm.
It's about how I got from Mississippi to Chicago, how I endured racism,
mm-hmm.
how I raised
mm-hmm.
a family, how I got by on federal gifts of cheese and flour when we didn't have anything to eat, and how I keep going from day to day, how I get up in the morning and move.
I
can't live without that faith, is what the mother is telling her daughter, and you must respect it. You have to, don't be so glib. Don't think you know everything.
Right.
Live
a
little bit of life. Walk a mile or two in my shoes. Suspend disbelief long enough to see what I'm talking about here.
Yeah.
This is a way of life.
Yeah.
This is a way
of
life, is what the mother is saying to her daughter. Not a claim about whether or not a certain event occurred.
Right. Well, that's why that's why I was wanting to have this conversation, because I'm a little confused, because you just gave an interpretation of what the mother is saying, where you said it's not about an event that occurred or whether it occurred or not. It's about life, and it's about a way of life. And I can't give you an intellectual account of the convictions that I have, but this is, you know, a way of life, and it's gotten me through, you know, it's what's gotten me through life. It's what moved me from Mississippi to Chicago. It's what made a way out of no way.
Exactly.
You know, turned dark yesterdays into bright tomorrows.
I'm telling you, this stuff is powerful, man.
It's why the arc of the moral universe is long, but it's turned toward justice.
Exactly.
I mean, it's about why truth crushed to earth will rise. But
God's not finished with us yet, and all that.
God is
stuff,
not
right?
finished with us yet. That's right. And then, what you're saying when you're describing the importance of convictions of this kind, and convictions may be the wrong word. I mean, convictions and attitudes and practices, a way of life. It's about the importance of them. That I would never have this conversation with somebody who was not at sufficient, you know, distance from the convictions to be kind of reporting on, you know, so, you know, a kind of a past self, because I think they cut so much to the core.
It's interesting how you say this. I agree, and you say you're confused, and it makes me think that I may be a little bit incoherent here myself. I mean, on the one hand, yeah. I say I can't believe. On yeah. the other hand, I give this case about why it is that people believe.
But, and what it is that they believe, what, you know, what the nature of religious conviction is. And on the one hand, you're saying you can't have it if you don't think that there's a God who's done certain things and that is, you know, gave his only begotten son, sacrificed in order to take the sins of his, you know, of humankind, to cleanse humankind of sins, and that there was an event in the world. It's about the blood. It was about... And on the one hand, there has to be some historical, you know, veracity there in order to believe. But on the other hand, there's a reading that you're giving about the nature of religious conviction that sort of points in a different direction.
And
it is something more about you know, life, and it's something that's more practical, and it isn't really about a set of, you know, of beliefs that you can list and subject to independent criticism. And
well,
you know,
I mean,
this
just,
is a topic
just
to be continued.
A small amendment, which is that, yeah, it should be continuing. I realize we're getting to the end. The small amendment yeah. would be what I was saying was that was the offense of the daughter
yes.
who
right.
questioned her mother's belief.
Yeah.
So she ought to have forborne, if that's a word. She ought not to have questioned.
Yes.
And the reason she ought not to have yes. questioned is she ought to have recognized exactly what it was that she was questioning mm-hmm. when she raised the question. Whether or not her yeah. question has value as a, you know, as a kind of epistemological
right.
matter is another question
yeah.
altogether.
Yeah.
I'll give this metaphor. You know, sometimes you're laying on the beach and you look up at the clouds and you can see Abraham Lincoln's face there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I mean, darn it, those clouds look just like old Abe Lincoln's profile mm-hmm. or whatever it is on Mount Rushmore. Then you turn your head away and you look back again, and for the life of you, you can't see it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of, you know, what it was like for me. I mean,
yes.
you know, I had doubt, and doubt, of course, is a part of faith, and, you know, yeah. these are deep questions
yeah.
here, but, I mean,
yeah.
there isn't anybody, you know, Mother Teresa, the doubt and all of that that came out in that report not long ago,
yes.
some of her correspondence that was released or whatever. Of course there's doubt, but even when I was a believer, when I was more of a believer or whatever, I could keep the doubt at bay. And then just one day I looked up and I couldn't find Abraham Lincoln's face anymore.
Yeah.
The doubt had just overwhelmed me.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
well,
I don't
one
know what
last question
to,
on this. Well, we can. I think this is a conversation that we should continue. I think it's a hard conversation to have, but I think it's worth having, and I'd like to keep it going. One last question on this, which is if I told you that over the next 10 years, I don't know, murder rates in the country are going to go down, you think, great, great news. If I told you that inequality had gone down, and the inequality had gone down not because all the wealthy people lost their money, but because
yeah.
people who are less well off were doing a lot better, I think you'd think, great,
yeah.
that's good news.
Right.
If I said that, you know, carbon in the atmosphere was diminishing, you'd say good news. If I said I can tell you with some confidence that over the next 10 years in the country, the level, the breadth, the level, the depth, the range of religious conviction is going to increase,
I got the feeling it's a trick question. I mean,
no.
Okay,
I'm just
well, you know, my worry would be, of course, what kind of religious belief,
yeah.
you know. And I'm glad to see that people like Pat Robertson and James Dobson
yeah.
and others don't seem to be able to determine who's going to be on the Supreme Court in the future. Although they have
yeah.
had great influence
yeah.
on who was elevated to the Supreme Court in the past. I'm glad to see that the set of attitudes about people who happen to be homosexual and the nature of their citizenship and the quality of their personhood seem to be moving in the direction of equality for those people in this country. If you looked over the last, 15, 20, 25 years or whatever, it seems to me that that's a trend that's going in, quote, the right direction. So if the result of this increase in religiosity were to be that those developments, the kind of discrediting of the ultra, ultra-Orthodox, except it has another meaning within Judaism, but you know what I mean. Conservative Protestantism, the discrediting of that, the sort of defanging of that, and the, I mentioned homosexuals, but I could give many other examples of, you know, policies. If you told me that the result of this religiosity was going to be that abortion was going to be outlawed in state after state and Roe was going to be overturned, I'd be alarmed at the increase in religiosity. On the other hand, if you told me that it was going to be an increase in religiosity, but of a kind that was consistent with certain public values of the sort that you know, you would be able to articulate better than me, being a political philosopher, of a tolerance, of a pluralism, of a kind of, you know, not the comprehensive, the embrace of comprehensive doctrines would grow, but the accommodation of a middle ground of civic and civil discourse and political cooperation would be sustained, I wouldn't have a problem with it.
It wasn't really a trick question. I was just distinguishing between. I guess it's the only answer that anybody could give to the question. But it did seem to me that there was a, this is a kind of. There's some truth in the idea that religion is no better than the people who have it. As opposed to thinking that, you know, religiosity makes people better. And I don't say that in, you know, disparaging of
if we were of a certain religious sensibility, what would be our attitudes toward poverty? If we were of a certain religious conviction, what would be our attitudes toward stewardship of the planet?
Yeah.
How would we look at 2.25 million people being locked up in jails in this country? What would we say about the militarism that seems so to animate our collective response to the tragic events of 9/11/01? You know, I mean, it strikes me that Martin Luther King's religiosity did wonders for the quality of America's public life. As they were applied, as his religious beliefs came to be embodied in a political practice and came to influence the course of events in the country. And I can imagine that across a broad set of fronts. I mean, if this born-again fundamentalist Protestant component of our society, which is large, were really to mobilize behind the gospel as understood by Josh Cohen and Glenn Lowry. That is, the gospel is understood by Glenn Lowry and the implications of the gospel as embraced by Josh Cohen. This would be a marvelous thing, I should think.
Yeah. Right. I guess, yeah. No, as I say, I don't have any, this doesn't come from an anti-religious animus, but just that, you make the point when you say the answer to the question is, you know, like with if inequality is reduced, you don't say, well, gee, it depends whether my response to that kind of depends. But with religiosity, the answer to the question, would you be happy or unhappy to hear that religiosity had increased is, you know, it depends. It depends on, you know, what the convictions are and who's holding them and what kind of role they play in people's lives and how it animates their conduct. One quick last question, and then we should stop, Glenn.
I just want to say this, Josh. I'd sum it up by modifying Christopher Hitchens' title. He says, God is not great. I would say, God can be great.
Right. In the hands of the right people. Quick comment on the presidential campaign.
It's heating up, huh? I saw Andrew Sullivan's piece in The Atlantic about why Obama matters, and I thought it was really kind of interesting. And he says, Obama transcends the generational conflict that comes out of the 60s, born of Vietnam and of the sort of cultural crisis of feminism and civil rights and all of that. And Obama is the best unstated advertisement you could give to a Muslim kid sitting in Damascus or Jakarta or Karachi about why the United States is really a much more complicated and benign place than he may have been told in the madrasa.
Right.
And all of that, and I thought that that was interesting. But I'm still for Hillary, mm-hmm. notwithstanding all the drawbacks, because I think she's savvy enough, and she and Bill, and tough enough to overcome the what I'm sure are going to be the fitful and desperate last throes, death knell of this right-wing conspiracy that's had our country in its throes for the last quarter of a century. I want to go with the grown-ups this time around.
Yeah, yeah, well, I can understand that.
But you say you're not all that happy with Hillary.
I'm not that happy with Hillary for a couple of different reasons, and I can't stand the stuff that she's been saying about Iran. I don't like her voting record on Iran. I do think that this is, an issue of, just gigantic importance. I mean, I don't love. I'm not an Ahmadinejad lover.
Two
articles in the next issue of Boston Review that just has come out, and the articles are now online. One is by Abbas Mileni, who teaches here at Stanford, and the other is by Akbar Ganji. And Abbas's article is about Ahmadinejad and where he comes from and how to think about him. And the Ganji article is about what he describes as gender apartheid in Iran. Wow. So these are both very critical pieces about Iran, but they are also, these are two guys who have been kind of central figures, particularly Ganji, in the campaign against any kind of U.S. military pressure on or attack on Iran. In fact, it comes back to the presidential issue, because I think their views are very well represented in the Obama campaign, and I think it's no accident. I think that there are, people are talking to people, and I think there's about one degree of separation between Obama and these guys.
I see.
And I don't know who Hillary is talking to, but the kind of the problem generically is that. She seems to feel a need, I understand why, feel a need to prove that she's tough, and it's partly a gender issue, and it's partly a Democrat issue, and it's partly a, where she's been in the past, but that need to prove herself tough could be, really, really costly, and I think Obama may be an adult to a fault, and that I know is your concern, but I don't have the sense of him as somebody who's feeling the need to prove that. He's certainly not going around trying to make that case, either very much in the campaign or on the foreign policy side, and the Iran issue really crystallizes it for me. So
I hear you, and I think there's a great deal of value in what you're saying. I'm really glad that Boston Review is out there and is writing pieces mm-hmm. like this. I'm certainly going to take a look at what you have been talking about. But the last thing I want to say to you is that, you could end up with Rudy Giuliani.
I'm afraid that we're going to end up with Rudy Giuliani if Hillary runs again.
Okay, so then that becomes an important question of whether or not you think your chances of ending up with Rudy Giuliani are reduced or increased if Obama is the nominee becomes an important question. Because I'm saying is the choices are not between an Obama who might be influenced by some people who you think have their heads on straight about Iran and a Hillary Clinton who might be posturing to try to show that she can be as tough as the next person. Those might not be the choices.
Right. I agree with you. And if I were sure that Hillary Clinton could beat Giuliani, then I would. That would move me some. The numbers are not looking too good on that. I also one last point for me is that I think I've said this before, not in conversations with you, but on Blogging Heads and conversations with Brink Lindsey, day one, January 21st, Hillary Clinton gets elected, and somewhere between 42% and 48% of the population hate her already. And living through 4 years of that or 8 years of that, given where we've been for the past 20 years, is a pretty dismal prospect. I don't think the negatives on Obama, or for that matter on Edwards, are quite so high. And I think it would end up being a pretty grim period. Now, it's true that you might say, that's like giving veto power over Hillary Clinton's election to her enemies.
Yes.
And, look, I The question is who's going to be president. Nobody's got the right to be president. And the sheer fact of, you know, kind of nasty, you know, degraded politics and turmoil keeps, you know, Hillary Clinton.
But they're wrong to hate her. I mean, you know, that were being said about a black candidate. I mean, it's true that Obama is not that kind of candidate, but you could imagine viable candidates about whom it would be said.
Right.
And not only is it wrong to give these people veto power, but I think we oughtn't to preclude that people can be won over by the way somebody governs. And you know, a lot of people hated Bush after Bush v. Gore, but a lot more people hated Bush after he got through running the country into the ground. So, you know.
I'll give you the last word on that.
To be continued, of course.
Okay, good to talk.
As always, Josh.
Okay.
Bye.